Today is Tuesday, May 12th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, White House staffers describe close quarters and concerns about spreading coronavirus.
You had Kevin Hassett, who was one of the president's top economic advisors through all of this, on one of the Sunday talk shows talking about how scary it is to go into the building every day.
South Africans, weary after 6 weeks of lockdown, wonder when it will end. Also ahead, Together But Apart, some big pop artists pair up for a quarantine music video. It's all on today's International Edition. As U.S. President Donald Trump pushes the nation to reopen, he is also confronting cases of the coronavirus in the White House itself. While staffers are being regularly tested, reporters at a news conference on Monday asked why Americans are not able to get tests.
If people want to get tested, they get tested. But for the most part, they shouldn't want to get tested. There's no reason. They feel good. They don't have sniffles. They don't have sore throats. They don't have any problem.
Trump went on to take aim at the nation's Democratic governors, accusing them of not wanting to open their states.
There just seems to be no effort on certain blue states to get back into gear. And the people aren't going to stand for it. They want to get back.
There have been at least two known positive cases of COVID-19 among White House staffers, which has put three of the nation's top medical experts in quarantine for being in contact with the people. While it's one of the most protected complexes in America, AP correspondent Darlene Superville says staffers are worried about working in the cramped quarters.
But when you get right down to it, there's still people with feelings and emotion. And I think the people that work there can't help but be concerned after the back-to-back reports last week of the president's valet being tested positive for coronavirus and then the vice president's press secretary also being tested positive for coronavirus.
She says while it's a prestigious place full of high-powered and hard-charging officials, they know that no one is immune from getting this virus.
The West Wing is a very old, cramped workspace, lots of small offices next to one another, and everyone is passing each other in these narrow hallways, going back and forth to multiple meetings every day. So there is definitely a feeling of concern there among staffers and the White House, and those particularly in the West Wing.
The U.S. coronavirus death toll has now topped 80,000. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says New York City also may have thousands more fatalities than the official numbers kept by the city and state. A CDC analysis says between mid-March and early May, about 24,000 more people died in the city than researchers would ordinarily expect. Meanwhile, as countries begin to lift lockdowns, a top world health official warned Monday that if countries reopen their economies without setting up strong contact tracing, testing, and isolation of those who test positive, the virus will take off again.
Shutting your eyes and trying to drive through this blind is about as silly an equation as I've seen. And I'm really concerned that certain countries are setting themselves up for some seriously blind driving over the next few months.
Dr. Michael Ryan, the World Health Organization's emergencies chief, said it's an uncomfortable reality, but nations must not be in denial.
We're seeing some hope as many countries exit these so-called lockdowns, and this is good. It allows economic life to return. But extreme vigilance is required, and not just vigilance. Many countries, as the DG has said, have made very systematic investments in building up their public health capacities during the lockdowns. Others have not.
Germany earlier reported an acceleration in new coronavirus infections after it took early steps to ease its lockdown. South Korea, another country that had succeeded in limiting virus infections, has also seen a new outbreak in nightclubs. Lebanon is on alert for a potential second wave of coronavirus cases following an alarming increase in local infections over the weekend. But some Lebanese say they fear dying of hunger more than from COVID-19. The illness caused by the virus as the tiny Mediterranean country's economic and financial crisis worsens. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman on Lebanon's economic uncertainty as the country grapples with the coronavirus.
Authorities in Lebanon say they had to strengthen measures against violators and extend a countrywide nightly curfew by 2 hours amid a spike in coronavirus cases, some involving people returning from abroad. Health Minister Hamed Hassan said one case involved a Lebanese returnee who should have isolated for 14 days but caused the transmission of infection to his family and to the people around him. Officials warned Lebanon might be locked down for 48 hours to conduct a field study in areas where the cases were found. The latest reports put the number of COVID-19 infections at 859 with 26 deaths. The coronavirus pandemic has compounded economic woes in Lebanon, which had plunged deep into financial crisis months before. Lebanese have seen the value of their savings tumble with the currency, the pound, losing more than half its value. Food prices have soared. Nearly 50% of Lebanese are living below the poverty line, and unemployment stands at 35%, according to the government. Many employed have seen their salaries slashed in half. Professor Habib Malik of the Lebanese American University tells VOA that hunger is driving anti-government protesters back to the streets following a spate of mass protests.
People are in such dire straits here. They're actually throwing caution to the wind when it comes to the virus and risking going out because the situation is so bad. There is famine, poverty, bankruptcy, and people will say, okay, if we're going to die, we might as well try and fight before we die rather than sit at home and avoid the virus and then starve to death. This is a very bleak kind of choice. It's scary.
The government and commercial banking sector are currently fighting over a plan to rescue the ailing economy, which is $91 billion in debt. The plan would include negotiations with the International Monetary Fund. Malik says potential IMF aid will likely bring more misery to ordinary Lebanese, who blame the entrenched political elite for years of corruption and mismanagement, and whom they see as responsible for the current mess.
This plan does not address some of the very basic issues, corruption, the repatriation of stolen funds. Repatriating stolen funds is a very slow and very difficult process that would require sustained legal pursuit of the culprits and international cooperation. The banks made huge profits as a result of the high interest they were giving people, and they were also benefiting from that. They siphoned out of Lebanon tens of billions of dollars, and we don't know where they are.
Lebanon's Prime Minister Hassan Diab said the government would ask for more than $10 billion from the IMF in the first phase of the loan plan. The IMF is expected to say it wants to see prior action on reform before the country asks for financial assistance. The United Nations in Lebanon has launched an emergency appeal requesting $350 million to help people who are most acutely at risk due to the COVID-19 outbreak and its immediate socioeconomic impact. While Malik and others welcome the call, analysts believe it's a drop in the bucket, and there's always the question of how the money will be used. Dale Gavlek for VOA News, Amman.
South Africa is entering its seventh week of restrictions in an attempt to slow the spread of coronavirus. Top officials say the measures have made a difference in transmission, but critics are calling for them to end more quickly, saying the restrictions are now themselves a burden on a population which has long struggled with inequality, poverty, and unemployment. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
To say South Africa is tired of the lockdown would be a gross understatement. Officials acknowledge the effect that a curfew and limitations on movement are having on the population's financial and mental health, but say they are holding firm against a bigger health threat, that of a virus that has killed 3.2% of those known to be infected in the World Health Organization's African region. The global death rate is about 7%, according to WHO statistics. The head of the opposition Democratic Alliance, John Steenhuisen, threw these provocative words at the ruling African National Congress.
We're no longer dealing with a COVID-19 crisis. We are dealing with a lockdown crisis, an ANC lockdown crisis, to be precise. Let me be very clear. There is no longer a justification to keep this hard lockdown in place. Government cannot even produce the justification. They cannot show us the modeling they use to decide when to ease and when to tighten restrictions. They cannot do this because they don't seem to know for sure themselves.
The initial five-week hard lockdown, which has now been replaced by slightly loosened restrictions, was aimed at buying the health system time to prepare for an inevitable wave of infections. Critics argue that that time is up, and that the harm done to livelihoods outweighs the risks faced by easing the restrictions. Most of the country is currently under what is known as Phase 4 of the eased lockdown, with a nighttime curfew and reduced shopping hours in place. The sale of alcohol and cigarettes remains illegal. Although several key sectors of the economy have gone back to work, many South Africans remain at home, unable to do so. Shabir Madi, professor of vaccinology at the University of the Witwatersrand, urged more targeted testing and screening, and huge improvements to water and sanitation. The lockdowns, he said, aren't enough.
And if we can't do that, unfortunately, what we're setting up ourselves for, irrespective of what policy government has, right? If we're not able to abide by those sort of conditions, if we can't create an environment for people to actually practice those sort of interventions, we're going to have a much quicker rate of transmission of the virus, and we're going to get a surge much sooner, and the peak with this wave probably will be much greater than we expect if those non-pharmaceutical interventions don't work.
At this time, the government is holding firm in its positions. Over the weekend, Health Minister William Kiza noted an alarming rise in new infections in the Western Cape and threatened that the nation may see a return to a total lockdown or heightened interventions of various forms in some areas where transmission is high. Steenhuisen opposes that.
The real tragedy playing out here is no longer the coronavirus, but the lockdown itself, because this lockdown is going to cost many more lives than it can possibly save.
President Cyril Ramaphosa has yet to say publicly when the restrictions might end. But in its Monday newsletter, the president said the nation was stepping up its testing, screening, and treatment regime. He noted the transition to the next phase of the coronavirus response, that of recovery, will be more difficult than the present one. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
As many businesses reopen across Nigeria, workers are adjusting to the new reality created by the COVID-19 pandemic, including shorter work hours, pay cuts, and higher unemployment. Nigerian authorities expect the jobless rate this year to hit 1 in 3, while the International Monetary Fund says the economy will shrink by 3.4%. Timothy Obaizu looks at how those recently unemployed are coping.
27-year-old Emmanuel Nobu searches his phone, hoping for a response from one of the many places he has recently approached for a job. He says it's not been easy for him since he was laid off from his bartending job at an Abuja nightclub in March following Nigeria's coronavirus lockdown.
You can imagine in a situation where you stay and you don't have any source of income, it's very difficult to bear. Being at home all through, nowhere to go, you just sleep, wake up, walk around, nothing to do, no engagement.
Nigerian authorities last week began easing a nationwide lockdown, but maintained restrictions on schools, religious bodies, and businesses like nightclubs, bars, and gardens where crowds usually gather. Millions of Nigerians, such as Emmanuel, whose livelihoods depend on these businesses and institutions, are having a hard time meeting their basic needs.
It even got to the extent that I wasn't able to get a recharge card to load in my phone. I can't make contact. It's just like most movies we watch, you see most people hopeless in the movie.
Nigeria has been battling high unemployment for many years. However, job losses triggered by the coronavirus pandemic is something new. Nigeria's labor officials predict the unemployment rate may hit 33% by the end of this year. The country director of the International Labour Organization, Dennis Zulu, says the coronavirus pandemic took a bad situation and made it even worse.
Over the past few years, we've been seeing an increase in the number of Nigerians who are unemployed. And also because of new and young Nigerians entering the labour market who are not able to find jobs, this has further exacerbated the situation. So now, coupled with the COVID-19 pandemic, the situation is of very serious concern, and it could get worse depending on how this pandemic evolves.
Businesses are reopening across Nigeria, but they are applying measures like shorter operating hours and pay cuts in order to survive this age of the coronavirus. Zulu says it could take them a while to stabilize.
We should not be oblivious to the fact that some of them are still struggling now because the weeks of shutdown really affected their ability to generate working capital, which they didn't use for their own business operations.
The International Monetary Fund, IMF, says Nigeria's oil-dependent economy will shrink by more than 3% this year because of the falling global oil prices triggered by the coronavirus lockdowns. That is not good news for Emmanuel Nobu. He plans to keep looking for work, but unless something dramatic happens, his job search may go on for months to come. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
The U.S. Supreme Court will later today, in a virtual session, begin considering efforts by the Democratic-led House of Representatives and a grand jury working with a prosecutor in New York City to obtain copies of President Donald Trump's financial records. Unlike recent presidents, Trump has refused to disclose his tax returns and other materials that would shed light on the scope of his wealth and his family-run real estate business. International Edition's Steve Miller spoke to Villanova University law professor Michael Moreland via Skype to get a better idea of what each side plans to argue and what a potential outcome could mean for the three branches of government.
There are actually three cases. Two of them involve subpoenas from committees of the House of Representatives that are seeking to investigate the president and his family, and for that purpose are trying to secure the tax records and financial records from the Trumps. And then another one involves an action by the Manhattan District Attorney. And so in all of them, it's a collision between, on the one hand, the arguments on behalf of the Manhattan District Attorney and the House of Representatives committees that they're entitled to this information, that it's part of their legitimate oversight and investigative process, versus the claims by the president and his lawyers that the president shouldn't be bothered and hampered, as it were, by this kind of, in their view, meddlesome, intrusive action by these actors.
Have there been any analogous cases in previous case law that kind of sets this up?
Well, the most famous one by far is United States versus Nixon, which involved the question of whether or not there could be a subpoena issued against President Nixon during the Watergate crisis. And in that case, the Supreme Court did hold that the president was subject to subpoena power. And so that's the precedent most friendly to the House of Representatives here. On the other side, though, are a set of, I'd say, more kind of customary arguments and arguments about the ways in which the presidency has what we call executive privilege or other kinds of ways of avoiding this kind of investigation.
This is, of course, regarding the current occupant of the White House. This is an election year. What could potentially come about from this since, you know, oral arguments are May 12th, but the decision won't come for some time?
Well, we expect the decision will at least come by the end of the Supreme Court's current term, which will be very end of June, beginning of July at the latest. And at that point, then, if the House is successful, for example, you can imagine the president having to comply with that subpoena, and then seeing what political hay the House committees can make out of that in the reelection campaign of the president.
If the White House is successful?
Well, if the White House is successful, then that's the end of the cases for now. That you can imagine there might be other efforts down the road, including when the president leaves office, whenever that is, to continue this kind of investigation, either in a congressional or criminal vein. But at least for now, it would establish a fairly broad principle of presidential immunity from certain kinds of these kinds of subpoenas.
Now, in terms of quote unquote presidential immunity, is there anything within the Constitution that lays out that kind of doctrine?
Well, that's certainly what the president's lawyers and the Department of Justice in this case are arguing, namely that as to the president himself, and the way they have a structural argument based in the Constitution, that because the president is set up by the Constitution itself, that it gives the president some measure of immunity from this kind of congressional oversight and intrusion. Interestingly, the court also recently asked for the parties to offer supplemental briefing on a question of whether or not this kind of case is even justiciable, which is the sort of fancy word for saying that whether the courts can weigh in on this kind of interbranch dispute between Congress and the president. Interestingly, though, both the House committees and the president's lawyers took the position that, yes, this dispute is justiciable and they want the Supreme Court to resolve it one way or the other.
Would the Supreme Court still have the option of ruling that it's not judiciable?
They would. I mean, the Supreme Court could decide on its own, notwithstanding the fact that the parties have urged it to decide the case one way or the other. The court could decide that this falls into basically kind of fight it out between them and that the courts have to stay out of those kinds of political disputes. Again, the parties haven't asked for that, but the court interestingly did ask about it, which might indicate some interest in their part on avoiding the dispute.
International Edition Steve Miller speaking with Villanova University law professor Michael Moreland. Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. Germany reported on Monday that new cases of coronavirus were accelerating exponentially after early steps to ease its lockdown. News that sounded a global alarm, even as businesses from Paris hair salons to Shanghai Disneyland began to reopen. Germany's Robert Koch Institute reported that the reproduction rate, the number of people each person infected with the coronavirus goes on to infect, had risen to 1.1. Any rate above one means the virus is spreading exponentially. Hong Kong authorities said Monday they arrested 230 people during a pro-democracy protest over the weekend after a sing-along demonstration at a shopping mall spilled out onto the streets of the Chinese-ruled city. Hundreds of riot police were deployed to disperse the protesters, with some members of the media caught up in the chaos. The actions evoked memories of the sometimes violent unrest that rocked the global financial hub there last year. And Iran's Navy says one of its warships accidentally struck another with a missile during an exercise, killing 19 sailors and wounding 15 others. The incident took place during training in the Gulf of Oman, a sensitive waterway that connects to the Strait of Hormuz, through which about a fifth of the world's oil passes. Iran regularly conducts exercises in the area. Stay with VOA for all the latest U.S. and world news. With planes sitting on tarmacs, empty hotel rooms, and citizens worldwide staying home, the pandemic is having a catastrophic impact on the travel industry, a major contributor to the global economy. Joining us now to talk about the coronavirus's impact on this expansive industry is Pauline Frommer, editorial director of Frommer Guidebooks and Frommers.com. She's also the host of The Travel Show on WABC. Thank you so much for being with us. So can the travel industry recover?
I think it's going to be forever changed, to be honest with you. The United States Travel Association recently put out guidelines for what the industry should do to build public confidence. And I sat in on the meeting where they announced these guidelines and took questions. And they happened to mention in passing that a third of all hospitality jobs in the United States have been lost, gone, vanished. Thousands, tens of thousands of people. So I think travel will be different. I think it will be less carefree for a couple of years. There's an organization that does business-to-business research, and they did a poll and found that within the next 6 months to a year, most Americans are going to confine their travels to road trips no longer than 100 miles from their homes. So I think that there's a bit of a fear of travel. Now, on the flip side of that, I remember after 9/11, during that week when nobody was traveling because the skies were closed, everybody was saying travel will never get back. It seemed very dark. And yet we did. So part of me thinks, am I just being an Eeyore or am I being realistic?
We're hearing about even some of these very large airlines not sure they can survive, much less all these other parts of the industry.
And Norwegian Cruise Lines has warned that it will probably have to file for bankruptcy and may not make it even with that. So, yeah, it's a dire situation for those in the travel industry. The industry is suffering perhaps more than any other, and it's such a large industry. People think of travel as a trivial pursuit, but it really is something that keeps millions of people working. There are estimates that one out of 11 human beings on this planet works in travel in some fashion.
It's obviously a big part of the economy, in the world economy.
Absolutely.
What about people that love to travel that have never even thought that it would be an issue, that they couldn't, but they're really itching to get out, particularly Americans, where this pandemic is still to some degree raging? Even if the government wants to reopen, the world might not be ready for us.
Yeah, we wrote an article on Frommers.com, our website, with the headline American Pariah. Unfortunately, because the response to this pandemic has been so chaotic compared with other Western nations, and because of the lack of testing, we have the most cases per capita in the world, and we also have the least knowledge of who has it and who doesn't. Just as we closed our borders to China when they were the hot spot, I am very worried that for a long time, Americans will not be welcome in other parts of the world because the world will not have a way of knowing if we're okay. A bunch of countries in Europe have announced their reopening plans, and most of them, like France and Ireland, probably won't be open to any visitors outside of those from the European Union until late July. Greece said they're going to do it earlier in June, but they want travelers to show some kind of certificate to show that they have the antibodies for the virus, which is something the World Health Organization would not approve of because they are saying there's not enough scientific knowledge to say that if you have the antibodies, you can't be a carrier, you can't get it again. So the science isn't backing what Greece wants to do, and we have nothing in place here in the United States to even begin to tackle that. I actually think it's smarter to buy a ticket now and have that uncertainty than wait and buy it later, because the airline CEOs have been having calls with their investors recently, and they have been telling them to build public confidence. They are going to only sell half of the seats on the planes so that there will be room on each plane for social distancing. But that's an expensive thing to do. So they have said, without mincing their words, that they expect airfares to rise 50% or more to allow them to only sell half the plane. So if you buy your ticket now, yeah, you might have to change the ticket. Your route might get changed. You might have to do a layover in a city you weren't expecting to, but you'll pay far less, I am predicting, than you would by buying your tickets later.
Sort of a confusing time, different than 9/11, where people were just afraid to fly, whereas countries, they want to open, they want the business, they want people to come. At the same time, they don't want to bring people in that are going to spread the virus and have this start all over again.
Right. It's going to be an interesting time. I mean, a lot will depend on when the vaccine can be made. A lot will depend on whether the science can prove that if you have antibodies, you're then safe. The country of Chile is betting on that. They're actually issuing immunity passports to allow people to return to daily life and to travel, which is one of the reasons the World Health Organization said, whoa, wait,
right.
Science
right.
Isn't there yet.
Pauline Frommer, editorial director of Frommer's Guidebooks and Frommer's.com. And Ariana Grande and Justin Bieber are together but apart in their latest video, Quarantine Collaboration Stuck With You. It features a montage of appearances from celebrity couples in lockdown. Bieber sings with his wife, model Hailey, while Grande at first sings alongside her dog, but at the end reveals her new boyfriend, reportedly real estate agent Dalton Gomez. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bundani, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Take care of yourselves and be well.
To know you better, kinda hope we're here forever. Nobody on these streets. If you told me that the world's ending, ain't no other way that I can spend it.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.